Hi, I'm Tony Clayton Lee, and you're welcome to the IMRO podcast. For over 50 years, Paul Brady has proven his worth as a highly proficient artist and performer who is creatively fluent in many genres and whose songs blend innate melody with lyrical strength. His songwriting style was once described by U2's Bono as the iron fist in a velvet glove. And we are delighted to have Paul Brady talk to the IMRO podcast about his life, his music, his recent memoir, Crazy Dreams, and how he has successfully maintained relevance in an ever-evolving music industry. Firstly, it's nice to talk to you again. I know it's a long time since we've spoken. And I suppose I'll start off with a question. Is it fair to say that prior to your memoir, Crazy Dreams, being published last September, and which opened up your life to the reader in a much more insightful way than they might have been used to, that you were perhaps cautious of talking about yourself, your life, your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I'm a private person, or at least I was before this memoir. And I was reluctant, I suppose, to be drawn into the music business as a media thing, as a competition thing. As a, you know, you have to find your level in something or other. I suppose saw me kind of, you know, keeping a distance, certainly from the media and, you know, and just trying to concentrate on the music that I made. And that was the thing that I was primarily interested in.
Right. How long had it been in your head to kind of want to write it or the need to write it?
Well, I started writing it probably about 5 years ago and probably subconsciously realizing that a lot of people were confused about actually what I was and who I was. And I mean, I've had a very kind of mixed upbringing and background from the north to the south and all that. I suppose I just felt that I wanted to... I suppose, talk about my background in a way that might throw some light on the music I eventually made.
Right. What light do you think did it shed?
Let me think about that. Well, I mean, I think a lot of the attitudes that I presented in the book to events as they passed me by and as I went through them showed me in a certain way that I don't think people might have understood before. It's hard to be precise about this, but yeah. I didn't come to music as a lifestyle. I came to music simply because I wanted to have a life of music and find out how much music was inside me and to try and play with it and to find out more about myself through the music that I was gifted with. Maybe that explained me more, better to people after having written it rather than I was before. I think people had this notion about me that I was surly and grumpy and didn't want to engage with people. I suppose I was trying to protect myself, you know. And I mean, I am nervous about interviews. You can tell right away I'm nervous now. It's hard to handle sometimes.
Sure. Okay. Maybe just getting back to the book a wee bit. When you were writing it, or as you were writing it, did you have any conflicts of interest that inhibited you from writing what you may have really, really wanted to write? Or did you just think, feck it, why not say it the way it was, the way it is?
No, a lot of the people have been surprised about how, they say, candid the book is, you know. And I suppose I'm a bit surprised myself. You know, I mean, I didn't put a cusk on me as I was writing it. You know, I didn't sort of, I wasn't always thinking, oh, what are people going to think if I say this? I just wanted to say it because this is how it was. And it was only when it was all finished that you could get a rounded picture of who I was and what music I had made, you know?
The initial impetus for you to want to be a songwriter or a singer, and that whole cultural impact, the cultural melting pot of pop music, when you were growing up. When do you think that really hit you?
Well, it hit me when I came to Dublin in 1964 to go to UCD, or rather, to not go to UCD. Because I had never been in a band before that. I was 17. And I mean, the thing is, at that time in Ireland, like in a town like Strabane, there weren't two or three groups, you know. I mean, there was a show band or two. And that's where people who played music ended up, in show bands. And some of them who played great music, you know. I mean, I'm not one of these ditters of the show band era. I just felt that's the way it was. It was the only outlet for people at the time. You know, if you wanted to make a mark in the global pop world, you had to leave Ireland. Like, you know, they all did. The Bachelors, you know, Rory Gallagher, you know, Thin Lizzy. Everybody left Ireland up until at least almost the end of the 70s, you know. I wasn't singing a lot or thinking of myself as a singer until I came to Dublin, and I fell under the spell of the rhythm and blues scene as it was in Dublin at the time. Yeah. And some people in particular, like Brendan Bonass, who introduced me to my first band.
How surprised were you when you moved to Dublin and when you actually discovered the Crystal Ballroom, as it was known then, McGonagall's later? Yeah. How surprised were you to discover that there actually wanted to do?
Yeah, it was a total surprise to me. I mean, I had only been in Dublin a couple of months. And, you know, I mean, I didn't travel much up before I came to Dublin. And, you know, apart from being born in Belfast and spending 2 days in a hospital there, I'd never been to Belfast since, you know. And so when I came to Dublin, it was about an accident. I was walking down the green, Stephen's Green, and there was a poster there, Rhythm Blues Extravaganza in the Crystal Ballroom, four bands, you know, Bluesville, which was Ian Whitcomb, and the Green Beats, the Semitones, and the Inmates. And Brendan Bonass was in the Inmates. And I just went, I have to go to this. So I went to it. And I mean, I talk a lot about it in the book because it's still, I can smell the atmosphere in the place to this day. I can visualize being in the Crystal Ballroom listening to that music. And it was a fundamental, exciting thing for me. And as I say in the book, I then exposed myself completely by begging to get into a band.
which worked. I mean, it did eventually.
It did work, yeah.
You mentioned Brendan Bonass, who I think was later in a band called Step Aside, if memory serves me right.
Yeah.
You really pestered him, didn't you?
I did pester him. And, you know, he gave me a start. And I suddenly found, when I was up on the stage with the drums and the bass behind me, I suddenly felt, I know how to do this, you know. This is not scary to me. And suddenly then I found my voice, both as a guitar player and as a singer.
But then the instinct, I think, was just there, wasn't it?
Well, it was there. I mean, I had obviously sung at parties when I was 14, 15, you know, bring your guitar, Paul, sort of thing, you know.
Yeah.
And I played piano a lot at home. And started working in the Holyrood in Mundoran just as a sort of a jobbing band member, you know, not really a band member, just somebody who backed people up when they got up and drunkenly sang, you know, that kind of way. But yes, it was a huge surprise to me to discover what Dublin had to offer, and it was very exciting.
Right. And how, as a matter of interest, how open-minded were you musically at that point? I mean, you saw the rhythm and blues acts that you have mentioned, but I think would it be fair to say that you were also, you know, you liked the Shadows, you liked the Clancy Brothers, you were quite open minded, can be quite unusual, because they just love what they love and that's it.
Well, I was always interested in all kinds of music, you know. It didn't matter to me if it was interesting. Well made, little sophisticated, you know, and melodic. I loved it. You know, I mean, I would listen to Perry Como in the same way I would listen to Mick Jagger, you know, that kind of way. Yeah. And the music that I grew up listening to when I would have been 4, 5, 6, 7 in the house was all, you know, it was Frank Sinatra, Dean Martin, you know, Andy Williams, all that kind of music. And I loved those tunes, those songs, you know, and I mean, in the '60s, of course, I loved everything from Burt Bacharach, God rest him, to the Rolling Stones, you know. And I mean, I couldn't understand this. Oh, are you a Stones or a Beatles fan? I'm a music fan.
Yes.
So I, you know, it took me a little longer to appreciate Irish traditional music. I mean, even though I spent a whole decade in that in the '70s, it's still. It was the mid to late 60s before it had enough of a profile in the mainstream in Ireland to even get noticed, you know.
Okay. Plus, I would imagine at that point, it was, and I could well be wrong on this, but it was a completely different music language, wasn't it? Trad to rhythm and blues. I mean, there were, obviously, they're polar opposites.
Yeah, they're completely different. I mean, the traditional instrumental music is a single line music. And, you know, it was only in our generation, the 70s, where we started to put harmony with it and arrangement and dynamic to it, you know, and all the different ways that the Bothy Band and Plangstean put together in the 70s. Yeah. That didn't exist in the 50s and 60s. And so you were listening to trad music as a single line form of music. And I was more interested, I suppose, in more complex music.
Yes.
Yeah. Until I discovered how much I loved the intensity of the Irish trad music.
And in relation to what you called complex music, I mean, you know, you started off, you know, very much part of that scene as that we've spoken about, that was initially you saw in the Crystal Ballroom. And then you started, I think, you know, mingling with other Irish musicians, such as Phil Linnett, whom you sold a guitar to, which I did not know until I read your book. And you were also supporting, like, UK bands that toured over here, like The Who and...
Yeah.
So...
Roy Orbison.
Yeah. So what was that like? I mean, because, you know, quite recently before those days, you were a naive kind of burgeoning, aspiring musician. Yet now you were supporting the likes of The Who.
Yeah, but that didn't mean anything career-wise at all in Dublin at the time. It was, okay, we were considered hot enough musically to be able to perform as a support act in the National Stadium to The Who and stuff like that. But that didn't mean we were going anywhere, because there was no outlet for a band like Rockhouse that I was in at the time. Right. There was no outlet. We were having fun. Right. We didn't even have management.
So there was zero infrastructure back then.
There was no infrastructure for the beat scene as opposed to the showband scene.
Sure. Okay.
And it was really only, it only started to, I mean, that's why people left. That's why Rory left and that's why Phil Linnett left. And I wasn't even considering, I still wasn't considering a career in music when I was playing in bands in UCD. Right. I was just having fun.
Right. You were still considering not going to UCD.
Yeah. No, I mean...
Were you academic back then? I mean, did you...
I was reasonably smart. I did well in my A-levels in Northern Ireland. I had three good A-levels, you know, and I was linguistically inclined, you know, French, Latin, Irish, and, you know, but I had no desire in academia per se. I mean, I didn't want to really study it in detail or anything, you know. I didn't even want to be in university. I went there because...
That's definitely clear from the book.
I went there because I got a scholarship, and the only reason I got a scholarship was because everybody in Northern Ireland got a scholarship if you got three A-levels. which was totally different to Republic.
Sure.
You know? Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, as I say, I kind of attended out of a feeling of guilt that, you know, all these people who are slaving their ass off down here to pay for their own education, and I'm sitting here going, you know, stuff it.
Sure.
When did you gradually engage with traditional music?
Well, it was... Well, it happened after I was discovered by the registrar of UCD and called to explain why I hadn't been in lectures for the previous year. I then left the final band I was in called Rockhouse. I left them and supposedly to go and study and do my degree, but I was out of the beat scene then. And I was staying in an apartment in or a flat with some dairy boys in Moyne Road, Ranelagh. And down below me, as I say in the book, was Mick Maloney and Donald Lunny. I just heard them, and we met and we played a game of poker and all that. And then suddenly the folk clubs were starting. And so I sold my electric guitar to fill it in and bought a Harmony Sovereign acoustic and started going around turning up in folk clubs as a floor singer, just sitting there with my guitar and going, you know, because nobody knew who I was, you know.
Sure, sure.
And
what was that like, that kind of transference from, you know, kind of rock music to trad? I mean, you sold the guitar to fill in it.
Yeah.
It's vague as to whether you actually got money for it or not.
I got some, not
all.
Got
some, okay. So was that a kind of line in the sand to a degree?
It was. It was a line in the sand, although I probably didn't realise it at the time. I was left the band because my parents said, leave the band, study. You know, I mean, the band broke up after I left, which was another series of guilty responses for me, you know. Yeah. Oh, you caused the band to break up, you know. You could have got another singer. But anyway, no, it was a whole change for me, and I found myself getting a bit of a reputation as a solo performer, and eventually I was asked to open for the Johnstons in the Embankment in Talla.
Okay, and just to put into context, the Johnstons were a kind of, well, you explain what the Johnstons
were. Well, the Johnstons were a top 10 Irish folk band. They were one of the biggest bands of the folk revival at the time. You had the Dubliners, you had the Ludlows, you had the Wolf Tones and the Johnstons, and then maybe Sweeney's Men. And I mean, there were other bands, of course, Dublin City Ramblers and things like that. But the Johnstons had a number one hit in Ireland, and they were huge. I was opening for them, and eventually, because of their own internal breakups, there was a spot for me, and they asked me, would I join? So I joined them in July 67.
Okay. You were 20 at that point?
I was just 20.
20. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Again, it's interesting the kind of the incremental steps that you take unwittingly, obviously.
Yeah.
People do that all the time,
yeah,
but which lead you to a certain point. So you joined the Johnsons, as the posters proclaimed, stars of TV and radio, and but they were a different kettle of fish, weren't they? I think it's fair to say.
To
what you had previously done.
Oh,
and maybe also to what you were expecting to happen.
Yeah. I mean, first, I'm not ashamed to say I was quite venal about it. And in a sense, when I joined the Johnsons, I said, this gives me a platform in professional music whereby I'm with a nationwide successful band. I kind of like what they're doing. I'm not sure I'm hugely into it, you know, but I'm quite happy to see where it takes me. And that's why I joined the Johnsons. It was like, I was being cute for the first time. I saw, here's a way for me to become a pro musician, making money enough to shut me mother and father up.
Sure.
You know?
Okay, right. Now, you say in the book, which I thought was very very interesting, that the show bands didn't like the Johnsons at all, did they?
No, they didn't like the successful folk bands who were touring around just doing a 20-minute spot in the middle of the evening.
And is that all? Is that the time allotted to bands like the Johnsons? Yeah. Is that all they would get?
Yeah, we would sing five songs. And then we would jump into the car and drive 20 miles down the road to the next place and do five more songs an hour later, you know.
Okay. So I'm presuming because of that structure that the Johnsons had management and they
the Johnsons
booking
did.
Agents and, things like that.
The Johnsons were a professional outfit. They were managed by Tom Costello, who was one of the big show band managers. Right. And the show band's managers got into the folk scene very quickly when they saw that there was a money spinner here. Yeah. And all of the folk bands then, you know, had management. So that's why we ended up in the mohair suits, because...
Sure, okay. And just to go back to the reason why the show bands didn't like that is because the show bands had to play for...
They had to play from 9 till 2 in the morning, right, whereas... Okay. But we came in and got at least the same fee as them, if not more, because we were a star of TV and radio, know.
Yeah.
And so they just... And we brought nothing with us. We had no... We just brought our guitars. We didn't bring any sound system.
Okay.
So it was out of the goodness of their heart that we were expecting that they would let us use their system.
Okay, so travel light, on stage, 20 minutes, off stage. Thank you very much.
Yeah, exactly.
Wow. How much would a stint like that get back in the day?
Well, I can't even, 50 quid or something, I don't know where that figure comes from.
No, but
put it like this. We were being managed by... a top show band manager. We weren't playing for nothing.
No, indeed not.
We were a top chart band, you know. I Never Will Marry, The Curry of Kildare, Johnson's Motor Car, you know, all that. Yeah. Hits.
Yeah, and as you write so insightfully in the book, you know, that entree into that level of success.
Yeah.
That really kind of made you very much aware of maybe what the music industry kind of was like. I mean, there's machinations, it's Machiavellian, unpredictable, it's anxiety-ridden and driven, and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
So did you, I presume you had no idea of that, of the hornet's nest you were kind of diving into.
None at all, you know, and as it began to reveal itself to me, I just didn't like it at all.
What did you not like about it?
I just didn't like the fact that it was so political, and it was so political in the small p, you know, and that it was competitive, and you had to achieve all the time. You had to build and grow and all, and compete with other bands and all that stuff.
But in fairness, like, a good foundation on which to build a career.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was great. I mean, particularly when the English folk scene started to happen and Fairport Convention and Steel Ice Bands started to come out of the woodwork in England. And then when English record labels saw that, this folk scene, there's money in the folk scene. And then what eventually became our label signed the Dubliners, Transatlantic Records. And once he signed the Dubliners, Nat Joseph was on the lookout for what was going on in Ireland, and the next band he heard of was us. So we were invited over, and when we got to England, and we started going to England in 1968 and doing some concerts there, and we moved there. Lucy left the band in January 1969, and we moved. Mick Maloney, myself, and Adrian Johnston moved over to England permanently. And started working the British folk scene then. From then, 69, 70, 71. We were one of the top bands in the UK at the time.
Okay.
We were constantly on the radio. I mean, we were doing sessions for national programs, daily programs like the Terry Wogan Show, like Jimmy Young's show. You know, we would be in Maida Vale BBC studios recording six or seven songs. They'd be played all the time during the week. We would do weekend shows and Country Meets Folk, you know, and there was folk on television at the time too. Tyne Tees Television had a series of folk music. We played on that. We played in Scotland at Hogmanay and with the Scottish National Orchestra in the open air up in Aviemore. You know, we were a big band in England. We were, without a doubt, one of the top bands in the English folk scene from 69 through to 72.
Okay, so I'm presuming during that time you thought you made a really good move.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I'd made a really good move in the sense that I was up on the professional level now. I had a structure around me and I was making good money.
Sure, okay. What about creativity? I mean, I think, was it when you started in the Johnsons that you actually began to write your own material?
No, it was in the first couple of years. I was with the Johnsons from 1967 through to 1974. So 7 years, six and a half, 7 years. Mm. For the first 2 or 3 years, I wasn't thinking of writing at all. And I was more interested in the trad aspect of things. And then when we got to England and we came across people like Nick Drake and Al Stewart and Sandy Denny and people like that who were starting to write their own songs, I felt a little bit of pressure coming on me from to start to see if I could write a song. But I wasn't actually, I mean, I wasn't very good at it, frankly. The first couple of songs I wrote were awful.
Well, that's kind of, that is par for the course in many, many artistic forms.
Yeah. And I was a huge fan of Jerry Rafferty when he was with the Humble Bums and Billy Connolly. That's when I first heard songs, new songs being written by people in the folk scene that I felt I would like to do this kind of thing too, you know. And so it was really in the latter half of my time with the Johnsons that I started to try and write songs.
Okay. Any particular ideas in your head as to what you wanted to do with those songs, or wanted to sound?
They were for making part of it to be a Johnsons album. Like I would sing a couple of songs. Mick Maloney would sing a couple of songs. Adrian Johnson would sing a couple of songs. You know, and I was trying to write songs. But it happened very slowly and took a while for it to... It didn't really happen me until I left the Johnsons. Mm. And it's almost like I had a little initial flurry of songwriting in the final couple of years of the Johnsons. But then when the Johnsons fell apart and I found myself right back in hardcore trad and Planxty and Andy Irvine and all that, I put my songwriting thing on ice in the back burner right up to the end of the 70s then. Okay. I didn't write any songs between 75 and 79, you know.
Okay, was there any reason for that?
Because I was totally into the trad at the time. I made the album with Andy, then I made my own album, my solo album, and it was all trad music. And it was like I just put my pop sensibilities and back on the back burner. And there was a lot of what was going on in the pop world in the 70s that I didn't really enjoy anyway.
You know? Okay. There was what aspects did you not enjoy?
Well, I mean, I never really liked the San Francisco scene, the hippy-dippy scene. I never liked the Doors. I never liked the Jefferson Airplane. You know, I liked the Birds, you know, but, you know, I just thought it was all a bit lightweight for some reason.
Okay. So that'd be in your Strabane, County Tyrone background, do you think, of just look at those Egypts over there wearing flowers in their hair.
Yeah, exactly. There was a lot of that. I hated the dress-ups. I hated the bell-bottoms. I hated the high-heel boots. You know, I was in the trad world, which was this polar opposite. It was like anybody who was seen to be trying to impressed by what they wore or how their attitude was eschewed immediately in the trad world. You were dumped. It couldn't have been more different.
Than yes.
Mark Bolan, I hated him, you know.
Right.
I just didn't like that scene at all.
Sure, okay. And was it, well, I mean, Was part of that just you could see that it was just so egocentric?
Well, it was like coming out of the richness of the 60s, you know, with that huge panoply of music. The 70s thing seemed to be much more about style rather than content, clothes rather than talent, you know.
Sure. Well, then when do you think did your artistic identity really land upon you? You mentioned that, you know, Planxty was pivotal in relation to, you know, giving you an idea of forming your own songs, writing your own songs. Was it around that time when you really felt that you were fashioning an artistic identity for you?
Well, yes. I mean, after 78, when I made Welcome Here, Kind Stranger, I took up a project about a Sean O'Casey songs called The Green Crow Cause. I was asked to arrange, compose, and produce a lot of that record. And that's where I started writing my own tunes to Sean O'Casey's words. Okay. And got started to get a feel for using instruments that weren't just trad instruments, like, you know, like I was learning how to arrange for strings, for cello, for brass, stuff like that. And that was my first experience in that kind of end of things. And then when that album came out in 1979, that was kind of around the same time that Jerry Rafferty started to get big, when his City to City album came out with Baker Street. And Baker Street just was my magic moment. When I heard the intro to Baker Street, I just said, what is this? And just from then on, I knew that I had to see if I could write songs myself.
Okay, and that's really when it started.
That's when it started.
And I presume then that led into the songs that eventually arrived on Hard Station.
Well, exactly. I mean, if you listen to Hard Station, if you listen to the intro and outro to Hard Station, it's distinctive, yes, and it's got its own thing and its own melody, but the chord structure is the very same as Baker Street, the intro and the outro of Baker Street.
Okay. Well, okay. Was Jerry Rafferty aware of that? Or
I don't know. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, a chord structure is a chord structure.
No, I know. I know.
But I built a whole other thing on top of that chord structure, which became then came the song Hard Station. Yeah.
Okay. So the songs, some of the songs that appeared on that album, which was released in 1981, you know, Busted Loose, the title track, Nothing But the Same Old Story. How are they formed in your head? Because they're quite tough. Like, they're tough songs. They are, in my opinion.
Well. Well, the 70s had been tough for me, and I had a lot of anger in me, I think, you know, and I mean, same old story was largely about my time in London with the Johnstons back in the early 70s, late 60s, early 70s, when the political shit had hit the fan big time in Ireland and had moved on to what they called the mainland. And so there was an awful lot of tension around and tension towards Irish people. And I felt that a lot just living as an Irish man in London, 69, 70, 71. And that annoyed me. And so that's what came out in the same old story.
In retrospect, when you look back at, you know, those songs, are you surprised that they were so angry, are so angry even now when you listen to them?
Well, no, I just felt they had a bit of attitude and balls, you know. I mean, and I always felt, even in my trad days, that I wanted to make an impact artistically. I don't know, it's not really make an impact is not the word, but I wanted to say something. I wanted what I was doing to mean something and to touch people and make them think about their own situations. And I think it was just a personality trait that I didn't want to spend. I wanted to mean something.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Which is what every song should anyway, I think. But yeah, you write at the end in the book, at the end of recording Heart Station, you say that you went, and these are not my words, Paul, I'm quoting you now, that you went temporarily insane and that paranoia cheated me of even a basic sense of satisfaction.
Yeah.
That's a very honest thing to say, you know. I mean, temporarily insane, we've all said that, you know. But the fact that you admitted to the kind of paranoia just sucking the life out of you.
Oh, yeah, it was absolutely awful. I couldn't even listen to it.
Right.
You know, and I thought it was worthless, you know, and I thought I'd made a balls of it, and I mean, that's just me, you know.
Right. Right. But was it just that rolling balls of anxiety within you that wasn't permitting you to enjoy or be satisfied by your creativity?
Yeah. I mean, you know, and I was being frustrated career-wise too. The album made a certain impact in Ireland, but, you know, took another year before it was remixed and then released in America before it made any waves there at all. And whatever waves it made there were minor, you know. Yeah. The album, as an act, I wasn't really making it outside Ireland. And I suppose I was at the age where I was ambitious.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, and you were also a family man at this point, I think, weren't you?
I had two kids and a mortgage, and I was ambitious. I was at an age where, you know, I've always been a strange mixture of, I knew I had a talent, I had a gift that was special. I knew I had been given that gift, but I kept feeling I wasn't making the most of it.
Okay. Well, yeah, probably. But in fairness, you were also thwarted left, right and centre by the music industry, by management, by record labels, by A&R guys who left, and new A&R guys who came in and didn't like the cut of your jib.
I know.
All of that kind of stuff.
Yeah, well, yeah.
I mean, it's not, on the one hand, it's absolute nonsense.
Yeah.
But on the other, it affects someone's lives. It affects too many people's lives.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's why I hate the music business as such. And, I mean, I don't even consider I'm in the music business now, you know. I'm back just making music for the sake of music, you know.
Right. Back then, it sounds, if you don't mind me saying so, as if you were a fairly hard person to be around. Is that a fair enough comment?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. My wife would agree. you know, I wanted to be successful. And I was being thwarted at all corners and even by myself, you know. I made things hard for myself.
But not anymore, I don't think.
No, I don't, you know, I don't even feel I'm in competing anymore, you know.
Right, okay. Is that has to be liberating.
What is, yeah.
When did that sense of, you know, when did you write your own non-competitive clause?
Well, it would have been probably the early noughties, you know, when I was finished. I was on Rykodisc at the time, and that came to an end, and I started my own label and started doing distribution deals and stuff like that, and I suddenly stopped wanting to be known more widely, globally. I just stopped. Because I can't emphasize how important the covers of my songs were in my career.
That's true, yeah. I mean, I was going to mention that. Tina Turner, Bonnie Raitt, at least.
I mean, that really was just a gold mine to me for the first 10 or 15 years. And it kind of made me feel that I didn't really need to make it as a solo artist or as a globally, that, you know, I could continue to play music. I mean, I have a following that liked the sound I made, you know, and liked the songs I wrote enough just to sort of, you know, make a living. And the songwriting was the icing on the cake.
Did the songs being covered offset any of that paranoia, non-satisfaction thing that we chatted about it too?
Yeah, but I think it was more just growing older, you know. I mean, I'm not proud of that feeling, that part of my life. I was difficult to be around. I found myself unhappy a lot of the time, you know.
Yeah.
I felt that I wasn't making an impact, and it was great to feel that I didn't have to make an impact anymore.
Right. Well, then, whereabouts are you now, or kind of much more recently, in your head and in your career, if you still want to call it a career, which I presume you do, because you're not done yet. So,
no.
Whereabouts are you now?
Well, I'm just saying yes to things that I want to do, and I'm getting asked to do a lot more things than I'm saying yes to.
Such as?
Well, gigs, you know, I mean, festivals. I kind of go, nah, I don't want to do that, you know. Some gigs, you know. Well, I'm going to New York in May to do 3 nights over there in the Irish Arts Centre. And that's the sort of thing that I like now. I don't want to ever tour America again.
Sure.
Couldn't be bothered, you know. Yeah, I don't care. I mean, I'm doing a whole bunch of gigs in April and May here in June. And, you know, they're small gigs. You know, I have enough of a, I'm lucky to have enough of a following that just likes the noise I make, you know.
And you're absolutely right, because I think you know within yourself that you have survived such a swirl and a storm of music industry, you know, nonsense, that you're able to kind of stand on your own 2 feet and make your own decisions. So I'm curious as to what you think about the survival rate of musicians younger than yourself, you know, who are not necessarily just starting off, but who are maybe semi-established or established.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on the way the industry is now?
It's harder now.
Yeah.
It's much harder for that next generation, you know. I don't know. I feel very, very lucky that I've managed to remain at the level I'm at. I mean, it's almost like I'm kind of established in a way, and I don't need to keep putting out new product all the time, you know. Although I did put a new album out this April, last April.
Sure.
I feel it would be very hard to start again, you know. I mean, and I feel for very talented artists, I'm not going to mention any names.
No, sure.
Who, you know, are struggling. I mean, maybe not struggling, but who are not going to get any bigger than they are.
Right. Do you think, is the level of industry interference the same as it was when you experienced?
I don't know.
You
don't understand?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, okay.
I haven't been exposed to that in a long time.
Okay. You sound relieved when you say that.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah.
It strikes me, Paul, that, you know, across the decades and your life that you've met, you've worked with, you've bumped into, you've socialized with so many people who are major names in the industry.
Yeah.
What I think you have achieved, and I'm quite sure you do too, you know, so much more than the 17-year-old Paul Brady from Strabane County, Tyrone would have ever imagined. So in retrospect, and if you could, what would you change? Or indeed, would you change nothing? Because if you change things, the butterfly effect kicks in and something else changes.
Yeah. Well, I think you're right. I don't think I'd change anything, you know. I mean, I am who I am. I made mistakes, but you learn from mistakes. I wouldn't have done much different, you know.
Right. In the introduction to the book, the poet Paul Muldoon says that You are dedicated to the notion of making yourself an instrument of the song, and that in effect, you are merely the deliverer of the songs, the postman, yeah, so to speak, and not necessarily the creator of them. Do you agree with that?
Well, I'm mystified by songwriting. Sometimes, you know, sometimes I think the song is just there and your job is to chisel it out and find it. I mean, I talk about in the book about vowel sounds. I don't know if you remember that, where I would have a piece of music in the car that I'd written and arranged in a demo, and I'd be driving along and I'd be roaring my head off trying to find a melody. And I'd find that when I'd come to a certain part of the song, I might be roaring the syllable or the vowel ooh rather than e, you know. And then when I'd eventually finish the lyrics of the song, it would have been an ooh sound in the word there. That I mean, it's almost like the word was there before I knew it was there.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
It does. It's spooky and it's a mystery, and maybe it should never be explained.
Yeah, I mean, It is kind of magic, and I mean, I don't write as much as I used to, and I probably miss that. I should write a bit more.
Okay. Well, maybe on that note, we'll say, Paul Brady, thank you very much for coming to the Imro podcast. It's been great talking to you, Paul. Thanks very much.
Thank you.